Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to this edition of Vatican Weekend. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, echoes of the days when the Papal Palace in Castel Gandolfo became a safe haven for tens of thousands of refugees escaping from the battlefronts south of Rome. The story of Jacob's ladder, brought alive by scripture scholar Archbishop Mark Benedict Coleridge. A brief virtual tour of the Roman Forum with Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who shares with us his scholarly knowledge of the world of ancient Rome. But first, I'd like to bring you the words of Pope Francis during his weekly general audience, which takes place each Wednesday in St. Peter's Square, with pilgrims from across the world. Philippa Hitchin reports.
Pope Francis began his reflections at the moment the prodigal son returns home, asking forgiveness for what he has done and telling his father, "I no longer deserve to be called your son." But on the contrary, he continued, "The only thing that matters to the father is that his son has returned home safe and sound." Thus he runs out to embrace him, restores his dignity by giving him clothes, sandals and a ring on his finger, and calls for a feast to celebrate his return.
Cosa bella la tenerezza del padre.
The Pope said the Father's tenderness and mercy overflows, and in the same way we know that even in the most difficult moments of our lives, God waits for us and longs to embrace us as his children.
Nella parabola c'è un altro figlio.
The Pope went on to explain how this parable talks about both the prodigal son and his older brother, who also needs to learn to accept the father's mercy. Though he has remained at home with his father, his words display no tenderness or thought for anyone but himself. Both the younger son, who is expecting to be punished, and the older son, who expects a reward for his good behaviour, are not acting according to God's love, which transcends both reward and punishment, the Pope said.
La gioia più grande per il padre.
The greatest joy for the father, the Pope stressed, is to see his two sons reunited and recognizing each other as brothers.
Fratelli.
Pope Francis noted that this parable ends without our knowing how the older brother responds to the father's invitation to celebrate his brother's return. Jesus is challenging each one of us, he said, to think about how we respond to God's invitation, to open our hearts to his reconciling love and to become merciful like the Father.
Misericordiosi come il padre.
I'm Philippa Hitchin.
Now stepping back in time. Gone down in history as the Pope of the Second World War, Pius XII has often been accused of alleged silence regarding the horrors of the Holocaust, but also of not doing enough to help the Jewish people survive this dramatic chapter in the history of their lives. But are these accusations of alleged silence really justified? If you wish to know more about what really happened, listen on to this programme, which is part of a series by the title of Echoes of an Era. The popes of the 20th century, remembered by those who knew them. The programme is about to begin with an archived recording of Pope Pius XII's Vatican radio message in Italian, followed by a translation of his words in English.
Di persone le quali senza veruna colpa propria, talora solo per ragioni di nazionalità o di stirpe, sono destinate.
Hundreds of thousands of persons, through no fault of their own, sometimes only for reasons of nationality or race, are destined to death or to a gradual extinction.
I cui orrori noi già fin dall'inizio più volte denunziamo.
It was Christmas 1942, and war had been raging for over 3 years. Pius XII had consistently, persistently denounced the horrors of the war and of the Holocaust.
e l'olocausto per un nuovo migliore ordine sociale.
His appeals for peace fell on deaf ears. His appeals for humanitarian relief did not.
The humanitarian work of Pius XII during the tragedy of World War II was extraordinary, because the human dimensions of the greatest war of history were staggering. Millions and millions of dead, and many more millions were innocent victims of the struggle of war, violence, bombing, deportations, starvation, and all that. And from the very first day, Pius XII knew that from his experience in World War I.
Jesuit historian Father Robert Graham, foremost expert on the Vatican and World War II, helped research and write four volumes of correspondence focusing on the Vatican's humanitarian activity during those tragic years of war.
A non-political activity, for which now they criticize him for not being political enough. He was a non-political voice, an angel of relief for millions and millions and millions of people.
That opinion was echoed in an editorial in the New York Times of Christmas 1942.
In these circumstances, no one would expect the Pope to speak as a political leader, or a war leader, or in any other role than in that of a preacher ordained to stand above the battle, tied impartially, as he says, to all people, and willing to collaborate in any new order which will bring a just peace.
We have to consider what the situation was at that particular time.
Sister Margherita Marchione spent several years collecting testimonies from some of the thousands of Italians whose lives were saved thanks to Pius XII's strategy of action.
A few of the sisters told me how frightened they were when the Nazi soldiers or the fascist soldiers would knock on the door and ask them if they had any Jews hidden in three of our convents right here in the city of Rome.
This was actually something Pope Pius XII asked religious to do in those war days, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, he did. He recommended to all the superiors of the convents and monasteries and different parishes to open the doors and to help save the Jewish refugees. He spread the word by word of mouth, because it was impossible for him to put in the newspapers what would have happened. The Nazis and the fascists would have gone directly to all the convents and monasteries.
Israel Zolli, chief rabbi of Rome during those years, confirmed this in his autobiography.
The Holy Father sent by hand a letter to the bishops, instructing them to lift the enclosure from the convents and monasteries so that they could become refuges for the Jews. I know of one convent where the sisters slept in the basement, giving up their beds to Jewish refugees. In the face of this charity, the fate of so many of the persecuted is especially tragic.
So impressed was Zolli with Pius XII's zeal in helping the Jewish people that when war was over, he converted to Catholicism, taking the Pope's name, Eugenio. But Rabbi Zolli was not the only one to recognize the Pope's zeal in defending the Jewish people. In January 1945, an extreme fascist, Roberto Farinacci, lamented.
For a few years, Pope Pius XII has fully espoused the Jewish cause to the point of offending the sensibilities of his flock. We never imagined that our pastor, the Vicar of Christ, the head of the Church, could one day be regarded as the most influential defender of the interests of the Jewish people.
Rather than being a silent pope, then, he worked in silence.
He did. He was a pope of action, I would say. I would call an underground railroad. And some authors have actually attributed saving the lives of 800,000 Jews and other refugees to Pope Pius XII himself through his representatives, who were the sisters and the priests and the monks in the different areas, and actually in the Vatican itself. Pope Pius XII was able to keep hidden in the Vatican thousands of Jews, not only in the Vatican itself, but in Castel Gandolfo, at his summer estate. For all the years of the war, Pius XII did not go to his summer estate, because during that period, he had these people hidden. And I have a lovely photograph, Veronica, that shows in a room of Castel Gandolfo, about 20 women holding their babies in their arms and feeding them and just living in the apartments of the Holy Father.
Did you ever see any of the refugees in Castel Gandolfo? Oh,
surely, because one of my headquarters was the Papal Villa, and women with their children were actually to the beautiful crucifix in front of the Papal apartments. You'd go and you'd find women bathing their children. The staircase leading up there, on every step, there was somebody sleeping.
Monsignor Carol Abbing worked closely with Pius XII in organising a relief network for thousands of people on the battlefronts south of Rome.
We were cut off practically from Rome, any kind of regular communication. Pius XII was always right through to the substance of something. And he might say, well, why are you telling me this? And he said, what do you plan to do? You see, which was logical. I'd actually not planned to do anything. And I said, well, I wouldn't even know how to begin. But I know these people, tens of thousands of people living in the caves, desperately making little caves themselves to get underground because they're terrified. Every day, bombardments and all. Their worldly goods are all there. Their wine is in the little wine cellar. And if they move, they lose everything, as I was able to see later. So I don't know what, but I said, I think that we should have a better picture of what it is, you see. So I said, I'd just like to see what can be done. And he said, God bless you, he said, let me know how I can help you. Without thinking of his own safety in any way, people never seem to value what happened. Whether Naz is happy about him, we say he never denounced them. It's not true. I was present every time, the New Year greetings to the diplomatic corps. And it's telling me, I used to shiver listening, and I'd look round and I'd see some of the diplomats with their drawn faces because these words are, they might bring a thunderbolt in the next day.
If the Gestapo had crossed the border between Italy and Vatican City, they would have found refugees hiding everywhere.
In November 43, by and by, the house got filled with people hiding from the Nazis for various reasons. Some because they were of Jewish race or origin, some of their political or military position. Also several young fellows, for the young people who hide in order not to be drafted.
Eva Maria Jung Iglesias was one of those who found asylum inside Vatican City.
So they were sleeping in the museum inside these ancient sarcophages. At least they were safe for a moment. And we made a service day and night around the clock of two who had to watch in case the SS would arrive. Had to be aware of this possibility that the Germans would come in, but fortunately they didn't.
And it was also from the Vatican that prisoners of war could keep in touch with their families.
Calling its correspondent in Bombay. The Vatican Radio is calling its correspondent in Sydney.
The Germans, they thought it was a source of espionage and they had nothing to do with it. And there was no messages from the Vatican Radio to Germany because it was prohibited to listen to the Vatican Radio. And that was a sore point with Pius XII. Well, as I said, they had a phobia, the Germans did, that this was an intelligence operation. Well, that just shows how little freedom of action the Vatican had in doing this charitable work. But it went ahead just the same. And it was a matter of great pride and consolation for the Pope to be able to demonstrate in this public way how he's concerned for the victims of war.
In England, after the war, the Illustrated London News acclaimed Pius XII as a hero. Winston Churchill's first cousin, Sir John Leslie, recalled.
I remember the Illustrated London News just after the war had a great double sheet coloured photograph of what they called Pius the Great. And it gave a resume of his life underneath. And they looked upon him as a great force for good in the war, which of course he was. And he became a hero, I'd say, the Pope, to England after the war.
And when the war was over, the Rome Jewish community hung the following notice in the city's Museum of Liberation.
The Congress of the Delegates of Italy's Jewish Communities, held in Rome for the first time after the liberation, feels profoundly the duty of directing reverent homage to Your Holiness, and to express the profound sense of gratitude which animates all Jews for the proof of human brotherhood furnished them by the Church during the years of persecution, and when their lives were placed in danger by the Nazi and fascist barbarity. Many times, priests suffered prison and concentration camps, sacrificing their own lives to assist the Jews by every means.
You've been listening to Echoes of an Era, the popes of the 20th century remembered by those who knew them. I hope you found this programme interesting. Meanwhile, as promised, let's join our favourite scripture scholar, Mark Benedict Coleridge, Archbishop of Brisbane in Australia, who's about to tell the tale of a character from our family tree of faith for his series Blood, Sweat and Tears in the Bible. He's Jacob.
Jacob, though in fact he has other names, and eventually he will be given the name Israel. So let's meet Jacob. He was the son of Isaac, whose name means laughter, you remember, and Rebekah, and therefore the grandson of Abraham and Sarah. He had a twin brother called Esau, a very different kind of a character, as twins often are. Jacob is consistently, even from birth as it were, he's presented as a trickster and an opportunist. He's certainly a lot smarter than his twin brother, because first of all he buys from his twin brother the rights, and they were very significant rights, of the firstborn, because in fact Esau was born before Jacob. And the price for those rights was a lunch. And then, even more remarkably, he steals the blessing of the firstborn from his old and blind father, Isaac. Now, this was also a big thing in the ancient world, this blessing of the firstborn. He steals it with his mother's help. Again, Rebekah was one of those powerful women who decided that Jacob was the one who should get the blessing, and she engineered things to ensure that that happened. But there's also a hint in the very ironic telling of the tale that Isaac knew exactly what was going on and agreed with Rebekah. So he steals the blessing, but then for the next few years of his life he runs away because he's racked with this fear that Esau is going to wreak vengeance upon him, as Esau, in a sense, should have, because of the way in which Jacob had treated him. Eventually, there's a fragile reconciliation between the two brothers, but they decide to part company forever, which was probably, in the circumstances, the best of resolutions. That in the midst of this world, this dark world of fear, this dream world, as it were, when his life is threatened by his own twin brother, God appears to him in that extraordinary scene at Bethel that we know as Jacob's ladder, where he has this dream, this vision in the night, in the darkness, the light in the darkness of the angels going up and down from heaven. And really what it is, it's a vision of the promise passing to him from Abraham, the great promise of life, through Isaac, his father, and now coming in the darkness as brilliant light to Jacob. So the trickster and the opportunist, gripped by fear in the time of darkness, is touched by the same God of the promise. Again, why Jacob? He wasn't worthy, but then worthiness for the Bible is never the issue. It's simply a question of what we would call grace. So the light comes to him in the darkness, the trickster receives the promise made to his grandfather and his father. But there is one splendid moment when the trickster himself is tricked. And this again is the irony of these biblical stories. And it's all about his marriage. Now he runs away and he works for a man called Laban. Laban has two daughters. One is very beautiful, the younger one, Rachel. And Jacob is desperate to marry Rachel. The other daughter is Leah, who's older and ugly. Now, what happens is, Laban says, yes, you can marry Rachel. All right, so the marriage goes forward. But on the marriage night, under cover of dark and a few drinks, Laban slips Leah into Jacob's bed, and it's only when he wakes up in the morning that he realizes that he has, as it were, consummated the marriage with Leah. So he's been tricked, because Laban says you can't marry the younger girl before the older girl. That's not just. It's Leah's right, whatever about her ugliness, it's her right as the firstborn to be the first married. So he ends up with two wives. Now, he never accepts Leah, and he never likes her children. She has a lot of children. Rachel initially struggles to have children, but eventually does. Jacob never really is reconciled to the thought of Leah and the fact of her children. And then we get the story of the rape of one of Jacob's daughters. This is years later. The rape of Dinah. Now, Dinah was the daughter of Leah, the loathed wife. She's raped by a guy called Shechem. And when the news comes to Jacob, he does nothing. He just sits there, as if stunned. But again, it's the opportunist pondering his opportunity. What might I get by way of recompense from Shechem and his clan? He's not worried about Dinah. He's worried about himself and what he can get. When Dinah's full brothers come in from the field, they are furious. They're not only furious that she's been raped, they're furious with Jacob because he's done nothing. And because he's seen this simply in terms of an opportunity to do well, to be compensated. Eventually, what happens is that these brothers of Dinah, the full brothers, the sons of Leah, slaughter Shechem and his clan. And this time Jacob's furious with them, with the boys, the brothers, because of what they've done, because he's missed his opportunity. And he chides the boys. He said, "Why have you done this?" And in the way the story is told, the two boys are made to say simply this: "Should he treat our sister as a harlot?" But the irony is, who does the "he" refer to? The rapist or to Jacob? We're not told, but it can apply just as easily to Jacob as to the rapist. Should he treat our sister as a harlot, just use Dinah to make the most of the opportunity? You see what I mean when I talk about light and darkness? This is a giant in our family tree, and a man who is presented as, in many ways, appalling, but still splendid in other ways, and the receiver of the great promise of God that comes always and only as grace. He dies in Egypt years later. He comes out a lot better from the great Joseph story that you know. But he dies in Egypt, having gone down to see Joseph, whom the brothers sold into slavery. And he's never forgotten, because when the children of Israel come to leave Egypt, the first thing they pick up and take with them, their greatest treasure, were the bones of Jacob, he who had received the promise.
Finally, why not join me on a tour of the Roman Forum I once went on with Carmelite Father Reginald Foster? I'm overlooking the Roman Forum. This is Julius Caesar's forum, I think. Father, your knowledge of this forum, I'm sure, is greater than mine. I mean, these look like a bunch of ruins. I can imagine the Roman chariots going by and prisoners in chains.
It's hard, especially, as to see that this was the center of the world for about 800 years.
Full of arches and...
A lot of people, they just look at it, they think this all existed at the same time, which it didn't. So it took hundreds and hundreds of years to build this thing up. I mean, that temple over there with the columns there, those six columns, is the temple of Saturn. Well, this is 490 before Christ. And then you have this thing, you see these three columns here, these beautiful columns, and the military insignia up on top. Well, this is in honor of the man.
It's a helmet and a shield and an arrow and an axe.
Exactly.
They're all carved into the travertine.
Yeah, exactly. This is in honor of the man who started the destruction of Jerusalem. As the Lord said, you know, stone upon a stone. In the year 68-69, he just started the destruction of Judea. And then there was a civil war here in Rome, and he was called to Rome as the emperor, and he stayed for 10 years, 69 to 79. But anyway, he started this thing, and so that was the Temple of Vespasian, going back to the wall here. His son finished the destruction of Jerusalem and tore down that's your whole Arch of Titus down there, Titus across from the Colosseum.
There's an arch here just bias as well.
You see, the difference in the times here is hard to imagine. People just kind of look on. This arch here is Septimius Severus. Okay, he died in the year 211 after Christ. And so this is much later. So Cicero didn't see this, Marcus Aurelius, no one saw this, you see. This is 300 years after Cicero. But you see, he put this arch over the main street of Rome, the Via Sacra, which ran right below the arch and connected there and went up to the Capitoline here.
What was the Via Sacra for? It's a sacred way. Well, why is it called Sacred Way?
There are about three or four reasons for the Via Sacra. One of them, as you see, across the way is the Palatine Hill. And this is the Capitoline Hill. And the two kings, Romulus over there and Tatius over here, met on a pathway right here. And they made this treaty of peace by which they joined the two hills together into one city, the city of Rome. It was considered sacred because of this famous treaty, the sacred treaty that made the city of Rome. Besides that, down the line there is the Vestal Virgins temple there, and also the high priest house is on the Via Sacra. There are about three or four reasons why it was called sacred, because of their history and for the people who lived by it, you see. So, you see this extra monument. You see that little one column standing all alone in the middle next to it, you see?
Yes,
well, that was put there by Smaragdus of Ravenna. This is in the 600s, so Rome had ceased to exist for about 175 years already. And you see the level of the city of Rome is that high, and the Greek emperor...
The base of the column.
Who was Phocas, had his representative in Ravenna. You probably ever saw the Greek mosaics and stuff in Ravenna. Well, he put that column up in honor of Phocas, but just to think of it, between that column and the temple over there of Saturn, you have practically 1,100 years.
Well, what strikes you is that once all these temples and arches were in place and standing, there wasn't a lot of place for the Romans, because, I mean, this was the hub of their city life,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it was very, very crowded down here, and that's why it extended out. And these different emperors put extensions across the street there, the boulevard now. Augustus was the first one. And then you had Nerva was the second one, and then Trajan put on that whole area that goes down to Piazza Venezia. And Julius Caesar, I'm sorry, is the really first one right below us, is the Forum of Julius Caesar. So this was all expanded, but again, it's a matter of 500-600 years when this was done.
What does the word forum actually mean in Latin?
Well, in Latin, forus means outside. So forum is the place outside. Let's say the free area, you see like the grass down below there. The free area that doesn't have any buildings on it.
So there wasn't a lot of space for that.
No, it was
kind of cramped.
Crunched in, yeah, and you see all like those massive bases there. Well, those were honorary columns, but again from the 300-400s. So Cicero never saw the base of those statues there at all. So that's when you look down at the forum, you have to kind of remember that you have 600-700 years of history that's going up and down here at the same time. So it wasn't all here like in Hollywood at the same time.
You were listening there to Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who was for many years and under many popes papal Latinist, and who is currently teaching Latin in the United States. That's all I have time for on today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Should you wish to find out more about our programming, be sure to check out our website at www.rv.va. Laudetur Jesus Christus.